This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tēnā koutou e te whānau. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ed Amon, for the podcast New Books in Australia and New Zealand Studies. I hope everybody is doing well out there. You've had a good summer. You're having a very happy, happy new year. New Zealand has been great. We've been having some great weather recently, especially in Auckland. Today is a fantastic day. We are talking to two great authors of the new book called called Stepping Up, COVID-19 Checkpoints and Rangatiratanga. The authors are Dr. Maria Barge, who whakapapa to Te Arawa and Ngāti Awa, and is an associate professor in Maori studies at Te Herenga Waka, which is the Victoria University of Wellington. And her research spans a broad range of topics, including Maori representation on local central government, Maori resource management, renewable energy, climate change, and diverse economies. The other author we have today is Luke Fitzmaurice. He's a teaching fellow in Maori studies at Te Herenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington again, and a PhD candidate in law at the University of Otago. His research covers topics related to Maori and the law, including family law, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and the rights of tamariki children, whānau, family in child protection system. And according to the book, he's a bit tired because he's a new father. So congratulations, Luke, and welcome to the podcast, you both.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so just to start with, I'll start with the with you, Maria. In terms of your background, just for our international audiences, what is your background and what has led you into academics?
Well, in some ways, I might not have ever left academics. I've always been passionate about politics and the state of the world and trying to make it a better place. And for me, also being a lover of books and reading and research, naturally, I've kind of hung around in the university as a space where I think it's, you know, not only desired, but kind of, you know, your job to be doing these sorts of things. So love that. And as you mentioned, I'm from Te Arawa Engatawa, which are iwi in the Bay of Plenty / Central North Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand. And always keen to help out my hapū and iwi as well. And so the issues that come before them I see as kind of key research topics. So, yeah.
Great, thank you. And Luke?
Yeah, I came to being an academic, I guess, through... I used to work in government, and I enjoyed that for a while, and that was what I did when I finished uni. And over time, just personally, I felt like there were these bigger questions that I wanted to ask and answer that weren't our role day-to-day when you're doing policy development, and they sometimes were. But the job was to get on with the job. And I always felt like there were these underlying questions that I wanted to be a part of answering and asking, that I felt academia was a way to do that and research was a way to do that. And the opportunity to teach as well was one that I really wanted to kind of seek out. And but those big questions were what kind of hooked me in. And so doing a PhD and kind of easing my way into the academic world was related to that. Yeah.
Well, that's quite fascinating, because for me as well, it was a bit of a, I'm not back in academia. I'm doing my master's. I don't know if that's considered academia. I guess it is. Master's
yes,
is.
Totally.
I always thought that PhD was academia. I was working in a pharmaceutical company for a while, and then they always being the brown guy in the company, they always thought that I knew things more than other people. And also I was reading up and I was very much interested in books, and I was trying to find my place in Aotearoa as well. I said, listen, this can't continue anymore. I need to do it properly. So I went into start doing the master's. So it's a great journey as everybody's on. Coming to the book, what really led you to write on this very specific topic? Because it's quite a divisive and popular, you can say, in a way that it always pops up, this topic, every time. Stepping up, the book, COVID-19 checkpoints and Rangatiratanga. So, what brought you to this kaupapa and to write about it?
There were a few things, I think. For me, one of the initial hooks was that I felt like, as you said, the checkpoints were very well known in a sense. They were often in the media and in the news a lot when they were established, and then ever since, really, they've featured. But I personally felt like there was this bigger story that wasn't part of those media narratives, that it was most often some people are doing this thing because of COVID, setting up checkpoints on the road, and some media stories said it was good, some media said it was bad, rah-de-rah-de-rah, but most often there was this lack of deeper exploration of what those things might mean. And I was just interested in digging into that, really, and finding out from the perspective of the people who ran the checkpoints, why did they do it? What were their motivations for setting them up? What were they hoping to achieve before, during, afterwards? And what does that say about this bigger, what's the bigger story there? Because I think when we think about something like rangatiratanga, for example, or Indigenous self-determination in any context, it's often this quite abstract idea to people who aren't very familiar with it. And even people who are enthusiastic about rangatiratanga and say Māori self-determination is a good thing, often, and I would have put myself in this category a while ago, couldn't specifically articulate or say what that might look like. And I felt like the checkpoints were a very concrete example of that and a very tangible way to tell a story around self-determination that was so well known at a surface level about what the checkpoints were and what they involved, but was this way to tell another story that people might be less familiar with. And then alongside that, to capture and share the perspectives of the people who were running it and who were out there on the front line every day during the lockdowns was another thing that we just personally going into the project wanted to do for their sake as well. So there were a few things in there that made it a project that felt worth pursuing.
Yeah, and you mentioned rangatiratanga. Just for our audiences, what is the significance of the concept? What is the significance of this concept in terms of Aotearoa and having this the partnership between Tangata Whenua and the government? And why is it so important for all people of New Zealand, Aotearoa?
Something about that. So rangatiratanga for international folks and possibly for some people in Aotearoa, they may not be familiar with rangatiratanga as a concept, but it is loosely self-determination, translated as self-determination, and of course it's one of the key elements of te tiriti or waitangi, as you mentioned, where te tino rangatiratanga was reaffirmed for Māori in that treaty between the British and Māori rangatira in 1840. So, you know, we know that there are two versions, one's in English, one's in te reo. We know under international law, in cases of dispute, we look to the indigenous text, and so that's where we look to the te reo Māori language version of te tiriti, in which we have this concept of rangatiratanga embedded there, being reaffirmed for Māori, so self-determination being reaffirmed for Māori. So that's something I think that for many Māori has been key to this idea of a partnership between the Crown and Māori since 1840, and a number of misunderstandings and disputes that we've had, in fact, can be traced back to the British trying to assert their assumption of sovereignty, and Māori firmly sitting with this rangatiratanga and wanting to keep that idea that these two strands of law and politics and economics actually would continue side by side.
It's very interesting. I did my last paper was in Indigenous psychologies, and I was asked by my professor to choose a Indigenous concept, and I chose Tino Rangatiratanga. And I, when I started to delve into it, it was one of those terms that you might call it gateway concepts. That once I dipped into it, it turns out rather than a swimming pool, it's like a whole ocean. So it is, it is the core to the tiriti, according to my understanding. My question is, it has been mentioned in the book at the later part, in the learnings part of it, but I think it's a good point to talk about it. Where does Tino Rangatiratanga apply in terms of levels? At the iwi level, at the hapu level, at the whānau level, at the individual level, and how does it apply to the Crown or for instance, the tangata treaty, who are not Māori?
I think it applies at all those levels, and one of the things we were keen to communicate is that from a Crown perspective, is often misunderstood. The Crown has had this tendency to narrow the concept as much as they can, and one way they have done that has been to only deal with iwi and even only deal with particular organizational structures within iwi. So they want to deal with the corporate runanga structures with iwi, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but it is not the only expression of rangatiratanga. Rangatiratanga is something that exists at a hapu level, and something that exists at a whānau level, and like you said, can even exist individually. I think those whānau and hapu groupings are the most neglected from a Crown perspective, is that it's inconvenient for the Crown to have to deal with those smaller groups, but from a te tiriti perspective, that's where rangatiratanga lies, and that's the duty that exists to not just force Indigenous peoples to cooperate with the Crown in whichever ways the Crown deems convenient for them, but in ways which actually are exercised and chosen by those groups and whatever forms they take. So they may take iwi level, and we saw that in some of the checkpoints they were iwi run, some were cooperation between different iwi, but others were on a much smaller community level and a whānau level and a hapu level, and those are just as valid and sometimes even more important.
So in terms of the triggering of this action of setting up the checkpoints, what did you think was the reason behind stepping up and doing taking this action. Where, you know, in other parts of the country, other communities did not, maybe, you know, in Christchurch, people didn't take this action. And non-Maori people also did not take this action. So what specifically were the reasons that led to people in these areas to take this action of setting up the checkpoints?
Some of the communities in particular that we spoke to had a real sense that the government had let them down in the past, and they had a very strong awareness of their vulnerability to COVID if it was allowed to come through. And so one was in the far north, where health resources there are just really neglected by the government over a very long period. One was on the east coast, where there's a similar situation. I think they had a 3-hour drive to the nearest hospital, which itself was a very small hospital. And this sense that they had to step up, there was a combination of things. So having to step up due to that isolation and that sense that no one was going to do it for them, a duty to do that for the people in their communities, and a right to do that based on their tikanga and what they knew to be right and their kind of duties towards their own people, was the combination of things that in some cases just made it seem like the only option and the logical thing to do from their perspective. Mm. This wasn't this determination of, oh, this is going to be controversial, maybe we should do it. It was like, this is just the only obvious thing for us, and how could we not?
And I think that comes back to a key aspect of rangatiratanga. Luke's mentioned tikanga Māori, Māori law is a core part of this framework. And within that, the responsibilities, those collective responsibilities of hapu to their people is a core part of this. So, you know, they saw that, as Luke said, that people are going to be vulnerable and already in precarious positions. And so they really needed to be looked after. And so that idea of being responsible for people and responsible, in fact, for the land and the natural environment is a core part of tikanga Māori and rangatiratanga is a larger element.
One thread I saw in the whole book was that we were going to do it. I mean, if it's accepted or not, people agree with it or not, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We were going to do it. It's our action. We took the action, and everybody, each of the four checkpoints, they did it in a different way. So, can you just outline some examples of the different ways that they went through it? Obviously, people have to buy the book to read all of it, but just some examples on what were the differences between the four.
There were a few differences. One was how they were organized. So this is something I alluded to before, that some were hapu-led checkpoints that just their hapu decided that was what they were going to do. Another was just a group of community members who initiated it themselves and ended up partnering with a health organization that was part of that community. The one we looked at in the far north was a collaboration between two different iwi. And the one that we looked at in Taranaki was one iwi that was part of a broader collective of eight iwi that were all in communication about it. So different organisational and authority structures. Some were a hard border, 24/7 on the checkpoint, not letting anyone in or out, which was in line with the government lockdown regulations of that period. Others were a major highway through the middle of the country, so that was not as much of a hard border, but was pulling people over and asking questions about whether they should be travelling, and then using it also as an opportunity for a public health response, that information on COVID, information on self-isolating and lockdown rules and those sorts of things. So using it as a mechanism for a broader initiative, not just stopping cars. And that was actually something that was common to all of the checkpoints. This was one part of a broader response that included things like food packages and health information and getting information generally about COVID and what was happening. This was quite early on in the pandemic when we were talking about their experiences. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and all of the checkpoints used the opportunity to be sharing their information with whānau and their communities. So some differences and some core similarities.
And also it's when the kōpapa then is then highlighted in the media and a different news item comes in, it's unfortunate that it is outlined in a way that there's a couple of guys, they just went on the road and then they put the road cones on and that's what they're doing, right? And then you get the sense of that's what's happening. And so when you read the book, you get an idea of what background work went behind setting up one checkpoint. And then afterwards, people felt the consequences of it in terms of their own relationships within the community and their relationship with the police. And then a positives came out of it as well in the end, that we will talk about that later. My question was why is it, and it might not be a thing related to the book, but why the deeper level of investigation not done by media when covering these topics? For instance, we only highlight what David Seymour has said or what someone else has said, and then we don't go deeper. So what are the main reasons around that?
I think the media are in some ways, we know there's a fair bit of research about racism in the media, but we also know that the media are pressed for time and they don't, they have a certain a time slot that they've got to fill for whether it's TV or radio or whatever. So they're pressed for time. So they're taking shortcuts to the fastest way of building their package to deliver. And so, we have had, over the years, key Māori journalists have tried to encourage reporters to add a little bit, even if it's sort of 30 seconds of the history of things at the beginning of stories to give it a better context. But I think often this is down to, and some might say this is a generous interpretation, but down to speed and needing to rush stories. I mean, others would say that you can see systematic racism in the media against Māori, and the sorts of voices that are privileged are those that are the loudest and, from particular elite, wealthy, usually Pākehā communities. So, there's different elements, I think, to it. One of the key points here, though, was that the reason to kind of share the stories of these heroes really on these checkpoints was to show all of the work that goes in, and in some ways to try and fight against those stereotypes that Māori are just sort of sitting around or waiting for things to happen to them. You know, when actually we know from being involved in Māori communities, people are so busy trying so hard to look after others, to look after again, the natural environment, and there are so many meetings on weekends. They're not just, out fluffing around in the spa pool. There are meetings, and in this case, rosters, late nights of people collecting resources together or delivering food parcels to people or finding cones, as you say, and signs and high-vis vests and masks. And, there's people mobilizing all of their networks, so much time and energy going into these sorts of things. And I think this is just one of the many examples of the kind of work that Māori are engaged in. And we know, I mean, some of the research on volunteering is a bit dated now, and perhaps if someone's interested in doing another thesis on that, they should. But we know from some of the research around volunteering in New Zealand, Māori have some of the highest levels of engagement in what we would call, mahi aroha or volunteer work. And that's because of those obligations, again, to community, to hapu, whānau hapu, marae as well, and your communities and the whenua. So people out killing possums and, engaged in protecting the environment in all sorts of ways. That's, again, all part of the time and energy Māori spend on their responsibilities.
Yeah, one thing I found very fascinating was that there was a system of bureaucracy was created within. Everybody just took up their responsibility, and then their own paperwork systems, and there were lines of you can say hierarchies within them, and they just set it up, and then it's like, we don't need anybody else's approval. We can do it ourselves. We don't need to wait for the government to step in.
And actually, you can see that in many places. If you look at marae and the way that marae operates in times of tangi, for example, or, you know, one great example was when, Te Atairangi Kahu, the Māori queen, passed away. And there were thousands of people descending on the marae to pay their respects to her. And again, it was the same sort of thing of mobilisation of rosters, and as you say, a kind of chain of command, if you like, everyone going about and doing their things and knowing their role and knowing what needs to be done and just getting on with it. And I think, coming back to the title of the book, Stepping Up, that was pretty much what people were doing. They knew what needed to be done, and they went out and did it. And I think we can see that at many different levels, including at marae during tangihana, that's the funeral, occasions of a funeral. You know, people need to cook. You don't know how many numbers of people are going to be coming on to the marae to pay their respects. So, you know, the purchasing of food, and then the cooking of food, and then the serving and looking after and caring for visitors all sort of takes place in a kind of seamless way. People know that has to be done, and so they just get on with looking after guests and all the formalities that needed to be engaged in. So, you know, I think we can, in many areas of Māori society, this tikanga continues to flourish, I would say, and needs to be given greater recognition.
I think the point about organisation was one thing that I learned as well, is that the different groups involved in the checkpoints had been in touch with each other, and they had, especially those who set them up early, had developed paperwork or protocols in their organisation that they had shared with others, and some of the ones to follow their lead used some of that and did some of their own things, but there was this cooperation between all the different groups that I didn't realize existed, and is another illustration of the systems and processes that do just get established, and are another example of rangatiratanga and self-determination actually being cooperative as well.
Yes, and it is. As they went on in the media as well, and when the second round of it came up in time of the traffic light system, they come up, there was essentially, I saw this usage of the words roadblock being used quite a lot, but these were not roadblocks, they were just checkpoints, just to say keep communities safe. So sometimes the wordings that are used in the media as well are kind of twisty in a way that they lead to a bit of a confrontation in the comment section, and I guess that favors well in terms of click rates, etc. One thing I wanted to ask, that there was this, and is discussed in the learning section, that rangatiratanga does not have to be initiated by the crown, or the partnership does not have to be initiated by the crown. And time again, through my studies as well, I've seen studies in the health sector as well, when Kopama Māori research are done, or things are done through tikanga, or are done for Māori, by Māori, they turn to success. So what is this niggling thing that is stopping the crown or other organization to just let go a little bit? What is this? It's happening now a little bit, that we see from some of the government initiatives, but what is this niggling thing that is stopping the government or the crown, and it is taking so many decades and hundreds of years?
I think the crown has a long history of reluctance to hand over power. and Maria might put it in stronger terms than that, but that there's this power imbalance between on the part of the Crown that sometimes in the face of the most obvious evidence, they still are hesitant to hand over any power. And there's this paternalism mixed with some racism, that there's this implicit assumption that only they can do certain things and only they can do things well. And in occasional circumstances, they'll invite others to join them. And I agree with you that that is starting to change, but it's changing very slowly. And there are still examples where there's refusal to change at all. And I think what we saw here was almost like catching them off guard, and not a deliberate attempt to catch them off guard, but this was a crisis. And I think the rubber hits the road in a crisis, and the government hesitated. I think overall they've done relatively well, but there was this hesitance to take strong, firm action straight away to protect communities in the face of an immediate threat that those communities were like, right, we're doing it for ourselves, and took that opportunity. And I think there's value in sharing that story because it illustrates that it was possible and it was good. And these weren't initiatives designed to exclusively protect Māori. They were for everyone. Everyone in those communities was vulnerable to COVID. And when you're in a pandemic, everyone is vulnerable if one of us is vulnerable. It's the most obvious example of that collective need to take care of each other. And so these were initiatives designed to help everybody. And that's been true of a lot of the Māori responses to the pandemic. I think I read a few weeks ago that in Auckland, the vast majority of people who've been vaccinated in West Auckland have done it through Te Whanau o Waipareira, a Māori provider out there. And they have been the most efficient, effective protector of all of the people in that community through a kaupapa Māori way of doing things. So I think we have these examples where it is good for everyone, but despite that, the Crown is still reluctant to hand over power. And this was an example of the benefits that can happen when they do, whether or not that was fully what was intended from the Crown in this instance is up for debate, but that's what ended up happening. And I think there's value in demonstrating the results of that.
So Luke said, Maria, you might put it in a stronger words. Are there stronger words?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an assumption of superiority and supremacy on the part of the Crown. And as Luke said, they've always been reluctant or consistently reluctant to relinquish power. And I think part of that is about the assumption of their own superiority and the assumption of parliamentary supremacy, in fact, and a singular idea of sovereignty. You know, this it sort of fundamentally goes back, I think, to some of these core elements, but the assumption of superiority is at the heart of it, despite actually, you know, much evidence to the contrary. And this is one of those cases. And I think another part of it has also been, and we've seen this in the way the vaccine and then the second shots and now the boosters are being rolled out, is also a fear of a perceived fear of a backlash from the dominant population. And, you know, if they seem to be favouring Māori in some particular way, and, you know, this sort of nonsense just keeps re-emerging in the discourse about it, despite what the public health experts say in terms of prioritising those who are vulnerable, prioritising equity considerations and so on, that continues to be fluffed to the side. But we can see change, and I guess that's where we kind of come to at the end of the book is some hopeful thoughts around change that we can see occurring in the area of law, where Luke is, in some government agencies and in some universities, And in our students that we see coming to the university, you know, their thinking is a little bit different. They're really keen to learn te reo Māori. They're interested in learning about tikanga Māori, Māori law, as a first source of law. And so that interest, I think, you know, is slow, but also growing. And that, I hope, will enable us to eventually have some sort of constitutional transformation then truly have a kind of tiriti-led country, in which case these sorts of decisions about pandemics or whatever can be jointly made in a genuine way.
Yes, and you have brought it to the point that I'm actually currently studying. I'm currently working on different formations of government based on Te Tiriti, and Matike Mai is my biggest source of information on that. However, I feel that there was some extensive work done by on the Matike Mai report, and then some suggestions were made in the He Puapua report later as well. And then before, there's been constitutional transformation work that has been happening in terms of consultation. Even before Matike Mai, big reports have been issued. My concern always is that it's kind of staying in the bubble. It never goes out. It stays in the bubble. And as soon as it comes out in the media, and then there's a backlash and the government backtracks and starts to say, no, this is not law. This is not law. And then it becomes an issue in that sense, rather than moving forward. Small things are happening now. This is health. Māori Health Authority is being established. I don't know where I was going through with this, but my point is that this book kind of exemplifies the fact that from a small community level to the government level, this can happen. Tino Rangatiratanga, Rangatiratanga is very, very possible, and there's no fear. There should be no fear around it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think one of the things that I've taken from this project is that I now believe it will be led from a community level, that the government could turn around tomorrow and say, we're changing the constitution, and it would be great, and I think they should, but I don't actually think it's the thing that would make the biggest difference. I think the thing that will make the biggest long-term difference is if we are resourcing and trusting these communities and whānau and hapū and iwi to exercise their authority themselves and believe that that is going to be good for everyone, and that and sharing the examples of that is how we build some of that momentum towards the bigger constitutional changes that do need to happen, but need a groundswell of support, I think, to an extent, to really stick long term. The pace of change is always very frustrating, and I fully agree with anyone who would say that the government needs to do more and has been really has let us down in things like what Maria was talking about, their refusal to follow the evidence on which communities are most vulnerable to this. So, but for me, that's an illustration that is not where change is coming from in the long term and in the most substantive ways. It's coming from communities who know what is needed and will just step up and do it. And the more we can enable that, the more that the sum of that is what we will one day call constitutional change, along with changes in law and policy that will enable that, but it will be this groundswell of change, not a prime minister one day deciding that everything is different now.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that point. But I go through comment sections of regular people quite a lot, and it's quite disheartening. So sometimes I have to turn them off all the time. This was the prime example of people just ignoring everything and just taking it on board and doing it themselves. Now, in terms of moving forward, is there anything that can be done in other sectors? Like this was the health sector. Or are there any examples happening at the moment in other sectors of Rangatiratanga being expressed in such a way?
I think there's things happening in every sector. Everywhere I look, there's change occurring. And even actually from the government side, I mean, I agree with what Luke was saying in terms of incremental change, in fact, has been, if you think of the proliferation of all the little things that have occurred over the last 30 years, you know, that has brought about so much more change than, you know, a kind of big bang event as such. Just small things have inched us forward. Of course, yes, you're right, we've had lots of steps backwards again, but the general flow of the tide is a bit like sea level rise. It's still occurring. Maybe that's a bad analogy. But I think everywhere that we look, from the kind of environmental policies, local government, things that are occurring, local government, national security, international trade. There's change occurring everywhere. And behind most of those changes are Māori who have been putting their time, effort, energy, tears, hopes and dreams into all of these areas to try and make small changes that will proliferate. And I think part of that is also a reflection of the decentralised way that tikanga Māori operates in a sort of dispersed way. But that is reflected in some of the current political systems we have. If you think about central government and then the kind of layers of regional councils and territorial authorities, we also already have a system which could easily and can easily better recognise a rangatiratanga sphere of political authority. It's not too huge a leap. So I think we can see rangatiratanga being enacted in lots of different areas around the place, and hapu, again, taking the lead in many of those spaces. So I think there's still a lot to be hopeful for. And still, you know, although there racism, you know, continues to resurrect itself and become visible in many places, there are still also other people that are quietly, you know, pacing alongside Māori, lots of tangata tiriti who are supportive of the things that Māori are doing, lots of tangata tiriti who will now say something publicly, you know, put themselves on the line to defend, you know, policies for Māori or practices that support Māori. And, you know, that continues to give me hope as well, seeing that support. And we need to work together as communities. We're all here. And, you know, the environment's in a dire state, as if we need to remind ourselves of that. And we need to work together to have a better and flourishing environment and better relationships between ourselves and between ourselves and, the natural environment. So, you know, we'll just keep plodding on, and I think there's still a lot to be hopeful for.
Well, that's that kind of brings me to that point of before we wrap up. I had that question in terms of if you take yourself out of your of the academic, or you take the academic head out and get out of the circle. In general population, do you think there is an understanding of the responsibility towards the te tiriti or the actual te tiriti and the concepts of tino rangatiratanga, mana motuhake? Is that a widespread understanding, or something needs to be done to have that understanding widespread?
I think there have been a lot of myths, and that's been something that has characterized the history of this country for the last 200 years, that when you say to someone, what do you know about the treaty? Do you think the treaty should be upheld? Any of those types of questions, you get a range of responses, but a lot of the negative ones, I think, are based on mistruths and myths. And in my view, what we need is to be unpacking and explaining some of what it actually means to uphold the treaty. So in the examples we've been talking about in the book and other examples that Maria has been mentioning, it's things like should the application of rangatiratanga as protected by te tiriti or waitangi in this context is should we let communities who know what's best for their whānau lead a response to a health crisis and knowing that they can and having ideas for what needs to happen, should we resource that properly and allow them to do that? And if you ask that question to an ordinary stranger on the street, I would say that 90% of people would say, absolutely. It would be crazy to not do that. And I'm not naive about the challenges of overcoming people's myths and biases and racism. But I think there's work which can be done there around actually explaining what it might look like to uphold te tiriti, because most of the time there will be far less pushback on those sorts of things. And I think that can be one important aspect of, from a Māori and a Pākehā perspective, Tauiwi perspective, of educating and understanding and having conversations with each other as a whole country about what this might look like, because I think it's less scary than people think. And I think the myths around te tiriti or waitangi have made that more scary for a lot of people than it actually will be.
Yes. Maria, you were saying nothing?
That's right. There's, you know, I still think in relation to people's specific hobbies or their area of work or whatever, you know, there are ways of continuing to explain what te tiriti might mean in those different contexts. And I think Luke's right. There's a lot of fear about and misunderstanding or myths about what that might be. And some of that's been exacerbated and sensationalized by the media over the past decades and been quite unhelpful. But I also hear a lot of non-Māori coming and saying, I'm keen, you know, I'm open to this. But what do you want me to do? You know, how do I uphold it? And so that's the more common question. It's not the kind of, is not sort of straight racism. It's actually people that they want to know the how. You know, what are they meant to be doing? There's an openness there to actually supporting Māori or being tiriti led, but they don't have a clue basically what they're supposed to do. And so I guess that's where some of the fear comes from is, are we going to do something wrong? And are the Māori people going to get angry at us? But the willingness and the openness is there. So I think we do have some space now to work on answering those how questions. And again, whether it's in health or national security or, you know, Parliament, that's a key question. What does it look like? And I think we do actually have lots of different examples in all these areas of what it could look like and what some amazingly successful partnerships have been in different areas. And I think it's sharing again those stories of success where Māori and non-Māori have worked together in quite different spaces, again, from, you know, test control to international trade, where Māori and non-Māori or Māori and the Crown, depending which way you're wanting to look at it, have worked together. And there are lots of those stories. And I think a key thing is now to keep sharing those. And that keeps people hopeful and helps answer the how are we going to do this question.
Now we've come to a point. I mean, I can talk about this subject because I'm studying it as well for hours and hours, and I cannot get better resource than you two on this to take all that information in. But I think we'd have to come to a wrap up now. Now, in terms of the book, it's a very academically written book, but it's very very, very easy to read. Like, for instance, there's the introduction to Tino Rangatiratanga. Then there is the case studies that people were talked to and how the research was done. And then the lessons which were learned, and obviously what's the way to the future. Have I grasped it correctly, the table of contents? here, so that people understand. Because we talked about several different kaupapa here, but obviously the book is basically based on the concept of Tinuranga Tiratanga and the checkpoints and how that exemplifies it. So, in the end, what's coming in the future for you? This is a customary question that we ask every time with every author. What's on the plate? Any big books coming through? Any big articles coming through? Any big topics of research you're working on?
I'm trying to finish my PhD, which has got a life of its own at the moment. So this is about the most coherent set of words I've strung together in weeks, to be honest. And I'm deep in that. So hopefully in the next few months, finishing that for me, and then we'll see what's next.
I'm involved in a couple of different projects. One is looking at Tiriti-led governances of the environment as part of one of our National Science Challenges, the Biological Heritage National Science Challenge. So that's a fair bit of work. And then also looking back at my own discipline of political science and international relations and trying to encourage those teaching in those departments within universities to think a little more about what being bicultural and bi-political in those places might mean. Again, part of a more international trend of decolonising disciplines and universities, but in our case, focused on our Tiriti framework.
Oh, nice. And any books coming out, Maria? Anything in works?
Actually, in a short while, I've got a book with Julie MacArthur, an edited collection on environment, politics and policy in Aotearoa, New Zealand, coming out. So there's some fantastic chapters in there. So that's one thing.
Oh, nice. Maybe we'll talk about that as well. So, thank you so much for taking up time to have a chat with me and for our listeners. It would be a quite useful conversation over a lengthy time, which was nice. It is a great book. It is a short book and is a quick read, so everybody should go to Huya Publications and order it now. And it will be a great addition to your learning. So thank you both for joining us, and everybody else, I'll see you with another book soon. Norera, tēnā koutou katoa.
Kia ora.